Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. This is Max and Friends. What's going on, y'all? I'm your host, Max Tucci. If you're tuning in for the first time tonight, well, thank you so much for joining me. If you're here before and you're going to be here again, I love you for listening. Here's the story. I'm like trains, planes, and automobiles in New York right now at Donahue's with my girl, Vanessa Noel. Speaking of Vanessa Noel, I want you all to know right now, go to VanessaNoel.com. I'll tweet it during the show because there you're going to find the ultimate in Valentine's Day gifts. That's right. Vanessa does an amazing candle called Stiletto. So if you just want your girl to be in stilettos, you could also burn stilettos with Vanessa's new candle. Bring the sexiness into the room. Speaking of sexy, she's also got amazing 100% natural baby cashmere hand-woven scarves. I have one myself, and we gave one away on Max's Favorite Things one holiday Christmas. They're a luxury addiction in couture colors. So go to VanessaNoel.com right now. It's not too late, y'all. Take a breath. Valentine's Day, you know, is my birthday. But I'm letting you know that sometimes women want more luxury in their life than panties wrapped up as roses in long stems. So mix that. Get some cashmere, because sometimes that's all you need to have on is some cashmere and a scarf. That's it. It's easy to get naked and have fun. This show is turning so sexual, but it's going to be fun, I promise you. Because, you know, I was at Sundance. I covered for ION South Florida. We had a wonderful time at Sundance. I had the most amazing interviews. Nate Parker, you hear it here first. I'm acting friends. We have his interview, a clip. Nate Parker is going to win the Oscar 2017. So I want you to listen to him. Check out his movie, The Birth of a Nation. I also had Penn and Teller. We had a great time with them and their movie, Director's Cut, Misty Pyle. Misty eyes. I'm like talking so fast because I have like 3 minutes to do this intro. So I'm just keeping it real with you. But stay tuned for all those wonderful clips from Sundance, my coverage there. Then after that, of course, Alan Watts is going to give us a wonderful teaching on how sick society is a hoax. Tweet me at Max Tucci and let me know why you think society is a hoax. Do you even think it is one? Tweet me at Max Tucci. Let's start an affair online. I think it's so much fun. No one knows but you and I and about 3 other million people that are out there looking at Twitter. But at Max Tucci is my Twitter. Other than that, I've got to say a big shout out to Jade Umbrella. Love them. The gifting suite during Sundance was awesome. I hope you guys had fun with Sean Scott, the love show. Next week, we're working on getting Courtney Six and all the ultimate things for Valentine's Day. But the ones right now, of course, are Vanessa Noel's cashmere scarves and stiletto candles. What else do we have to chat about? So much. Tonight, we have Maddie Brown, we have Nate Parker, we have, I don't even know how many treats we have for you tonight, but I'm going to take my break now, but don't go anywhere. Stick it to LA Talk Radio, Max and Friends. Here's the deal, 8 years we're here, so happy birthday to LA Talk Radio, 8 years. And I love that LA Talk Radio is an Aquarius like me. Oh, a couple days ago, Oprah's birthday, so happy birthday, Oprah. You all care? Oh, the things we have to say, just to say them. Sometimes silence is like the harmony. Silence, I believe, is the harmony of sound, and silence is the symphony of sound. So with the symphony of sound right now, we're going to give you my coverage from Sundance. Had a great time. Again, I have to tell you all what a great time I had there, because next year I want to see you there. And Alan Watts, I love you all for listening. I'm going to sign off now, only so that we can give you some amazing interviews from Sundance, some Alan Watts. Love one another, people. I want to see like more kindness. Be kind to one another. More love in this world. I know it sounds so like cliche and ridiculous, but it really makes people's day so much happier. And have a good conversation with your friend. That's what I'm going to do right now, continue my conversation with my friend Vanessa Noel while you all listen to Max and Friends. And don't think I'm not going to be listening in, and don't think I'm not going to be tweeting with you at Max Tucci, because I will. So hit me up there. I love you for listening. Have a great week. Good night. Good karma. I know it's too soon, but take life to the max this week and tweet me at Max Tucci and let me know what you're getting, the one you love, for Valentine's Day. I'll check you all next Sunday here on Max and Friends every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 11 p.m. Eastern on LA Talk Radio. By the way, go get the free app right now at the App Store, and you can take me to bed with you every Sunday night. Good night, good karma. Stay tuned. Don't touch the dial. Stay here right now on Max and Friends. We're giving you Sundance coverage and then Alan Watts. I'm Max Tucci, your host for Max and Friends on LA Talk Radio. Hit it, Ronnie.
Hey, this is Max Tucci with Ion South Florida. We're here with my friend Lee Broda. Y'all remember her from our last coverage and from the radio show. Welcome back to Sundance.
Thank you, Max.
Now, you have two films here. Tell us about them.
I do. I have two films, one called Antibirth. It's a sci-fi horror film that I'm super excited about. It's premiere Monday. And then another one called Outlaws and Angels, which is a dark western thriller.
Dark seems to be like the theme now. What's going on?
I know, right? I have two in the midnight screening, which is very different than my last year, which was a period drama.
Yep. And now you're like cowboy, dark, fun. What made you get there?
Get where?
To that whole mindset of being...
Oh, doing those things?
Yeah.
I usually just make great movies with great actors and great directors. It doesn't matter which genre. I just... like making good movies, yeah.
Now, who are in some of these films?
Chad Michael Murray in one, and Luke Wilson, and Francesco Eastwood in Outlaws and Angels, and in Antibirth is Natasha Lyonne, Mark Webber, Chloe Savion. So we have, like, nice actors.
You have a good cast.
Yeah.
And now you're here with your mom?
I am. She came here all the way from Israel.
The last I interviewed your mom, it was like during some crazy stuff happening. There were like bombs dropping.
Oh, yeah.
It was quite the interview, but I'm glad to see she's here.
Yeah, she's here. I'm so happy to share it with her and my family back home.
And now, what does Sundance represent to you?
Dreams and inspiration and obviously filmmaking at its best. Art. At the end of the day, we're all here to make art. So that's what it is, and it's a dream come true. I came here, this is my fifth Sundance, and it's funny, I just wrote a post on Facebook that the difference between 5 years ago and now and last year is just incredible, and I'm so grateful.
And the last time we had interviewed you was the Disney film, and then you came to Florida, and it was super exciting. We got you there, so you're like, we love you over here at Ion South Florida.
Thank you. You guys are very supportive.
You
I love it, yeah.
Now, what's next for you after Sundance? I know everyone wants to promote now, but what's like going on for you next?
I actually have a movie filming right now in L.A. called Swing State, which is a political satire. So another one that is totally different. with Billy Zane and some great, great actors, Lydia Hearst. And we're actually wrapping tomorrow, so I'm acting in that one and executive producing. And
Lee has every single title, by the way.
Not every, but a few.
You're an actor, producer, director.
Yeah. I just like to be busy, you know, and involved in movies. And it doesn't matter if it's in front of the camera or behind.
Well, and here we are in front of the camera for Ion South Florida. I'm Max Tucci with Lee Broda. This is Max Tucci for Ion South Florida. I'm here with Maddie Brown at the Airbnb house here in Sundance on Main Street. And Maddie Brown, I tweeted like 2 years ago, there was a really great short film that you did called A Mother's Song.
Yeah.
And it was really touching, inspiring. How did you come across this like beautiful mother who had lost her son, who was an amazing artist?
Well, she like walks through all the streets like singing like just like opera and stuff like that. And I was just intrigued by why she does it, like like a lot of people think that she's crazy. A lot of people think that she's inspiring, right, stuff like right. that. So I'm like, hey, you know, can I just like, you know, have just like a little talk with you about mm-hmm. this? And I filmed her, and it just something it's came out that's just like, it just kind of blew me away. The kind of stuff that the really deep, you know, kind of deep seated stuff that just came out of her was really like intense. So it wasn't expected that yeah. that was going to come out, you know.
And it totally worked out. Now here we are at Sundance, literally 2 years later. You liked the tweet, and how did you get involved with Airbnb?
They contacted Vimeo, who's kind of like my, like, you know, godmother, basically. they're like the best people in the world, basically. And they, like, you know, teamed up, and they just kind of honed in on me and said, Maddie, we want to have you be the kind of the face of this big global, you know, contest where a person would win a trip with me here. And then so it just kind of spiraled into this amazing, like, adventure with these guys. And they've just kind of thrust me into this wild, like, family-oriented, like, feeling with all the staff here. You know, it's just amazing to be here with these guys, you know.
Absolutely. Now, who was the person that won?
Her name is Lexi, and she made a short film about a kid named Carson. And he, I think he broke his back, his spine, on a trampoline about 2 years ago. Yet he's like a swimmer, and he still swims even though he like can't use his, like, you know, legs. Mm-hmm. And so through that, she kind of said that he was her favorite local, like, you know, person mm-hmm. in her town. And so it just kind of, I mean, it's just the most heartfelt story, yeah, yeah. you know. And so we just whisked her like away mm-hmm. here, and we're gonna go see like a movie soon. So
awesome. But tell us the whole concept of the Airbnb videos, because what they were, they were like local celebrities you had to find, or someone that inspired you and love. Tell us about that, how those videos worked.
So it's basically someone in your, like, neighborhood who is intriguing, whether they put hats on their dogs or they cut people's hair in the alleyway, like random stuff like that. And you have to post a picture or like a video or just a tweet online through any social media. And they kind of look through the, like, hundreds or thousands of entries, and they hone it down to the top 20, and then those top 20 go to the top 6, which are put on their, like, blog. And then there's, like, a special one person who gets to come here and stuff. And so we kind of talk through, like, certain things. And then I'm also making a film. It's going to be their, like, anthem film. And I'm taking my favorite ones, and I'm making this, like, global piece of all of the entries, and I'm going to recreate all their images in my own eyes, like, through, like, film. So that's it'll wild. Be really interesting. It's a crazy project. So.
Did you think, like, all this was going to happen to you?
What do you mean?
Like, being here at Sundance with Airbnb, with Vimeo, and all these people, well, like, so making films to live with you.
Well, if someone told me a year ago that, like, oh, you would be the VIP, like, Airbnb guy, I was like, oh, yeah, right. I don't think so. So, yeah, I mean, it's a wild, cool trip, and hopefully I'll, like, have a film here next year, you know?
Well, speaking of trips, you're doing another film right now, so tell us about that in a whole other language that you don't speak. So what's up with that?
Yeah, well, I really like, you know, challenging things, and so I think I'm making a Portuguese foreign film, and it's all in, like, in Portuguese, and I don't speak Portuguese, so we'll have, like, translators for, like, you know, production, through the editing, through every single process of it. But it's a very wild, like, imaginative, like, sad but, like, inspiring kind of film. But I've been so in love with this story for the last, you know, 2 years. And now I think I'm ready to actually start making, like, you know, narratives, like, as like a full-on thing. So we're just punching through it. I have, like, meetings, like, you know, later on with, like, a few people that we're going to start, you know, just, like, you know, getting, like, the momentum going on it, you know. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for hanging out with us here. Ion South Florida. Maddie Brown is someone that you're going to keep your eye on. I'm Max Tucci for Ion South Florida. You're here at Sundance. What is the vibe for you, and how are you feeling being here?
I mean, it's a great vibe. I mean, just to be here with the institution, Sundance Institute, supported my project for a number of years. So to be here celebrating the project and celebrating, you know, their just championing of filmmakers is a wonderful thing. So I'm very excited. I feel very humbled.
How does it feel? Like, you're going to be a role model now for, like, little guys watching you. What do you tell them who, you know, it's with the whole Trayvon Martins and everyone? And how do you tell people, like, listen, I'm here, I'm representing. What do you tell those little boys tonight?
You know, if I'm representing anything, I want to represent someone that feels that we need to attack injustice head on. It's the only way toward healing, you know, honest confrontation. We need to deal with the injustices we see around us and have a riotous disposition toward solving those problems. And this film, for me, is just an extension of that, something I feel very strongly about, whether it be racial inequality or, you know, sexual inequality or gender inequality, just to have a riotous disposition toward any kind of injustice toward those things. And, you know, this film deals with, you know, 1831, you know, antebellum South, slavery, a system that existed that people weren't brave enough to stand against, and Nat Turner was someone that had that courage. And I feel like when speaking to young people, I say, whatever your circles, your environments, you see things that are wrong, seeing things that you don't believe in, don't be passive, because if you're passive, then you become complicit and then you become corrupt. So hopefully that's something that when they watch the film and they hear me speak, or I speak to them on the street, something they can take from me.
And now, what's going on next for you?
That's a good question. I mean, I have a lot of things I'm developing right now. I just want to sell my movie. You know, I'm here with The Birth of a Nation. It's something I'm very proud of. I feel like this film is very much my vision, you know. It's something that I've been working on for 7 years, and here we are. So I just hope that people respond to it in a positive way, and that hopefully they watch the film and they become change agents. You know, it's something that that it affects them to the point where they want to do something different.
And now, what are they going to take out of it?
Just everything that I've been talking about. I hope that, you know, the audience member watches the film and comes out and asks themselves, you know, what systems exist in my circles that aren't positive or aren't, reflecting justice, that I can be a change agent and deal with that injustice and create progress. That's what I hope. You know, I mean, the film, I mean, that's what we do. We want to subvert, and we want to change systems, and we want to create change.
And you're making that change.
I hope so.
You are. No.
Thank you very much.
You know, it all starts with that one seed. You got to plant it, right?
Right.
So what are you going to... So now, do you have anything else that you're working on personally right now, writing or directing?
Nothing that I'm really comfortable talking about yet. Like I said, I'm here to sell this film. I have a lot of things I'm working on. The thing is, you know, when you do something that you're passionate about, you the feeling, it's so euphoric because you know what it means to you. So now I'm just looking for that next thing that makes me feel the way that this last film made me feel. I don't want to do anything that I don't want to be a part of my legacy. So I take my time. Just look.
What do you want your legacy to be?
That I stood for growth and progress. That I was a bully when it came to injustice. That I had the courage to speak up. You know, anyone that knows me knows that I don't hold my tongue. I don't do it in life, and I don't do it in my art. So I just hope that I can continue to subvert, that if my kids or my kids' kids look at my films or look at anything that I've done, whether it be coaching or it be just being a human being, that I look for systems that were unjust and I look to overturn them.
This is Max Tucci for Ion South Florida. I'm here with the stream queen, Victoria Fratz. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Max. Hi.
So we're here at Sundance. And tell us about how you are, like, Miss Viral.
Well, I live stream basically my whole life, and I'm here in Sundance giving everyone a behind-the-scenes peek at Sundance 2016.
It is at Sundance 2016. Now it's your first time here?
It is, yeah.
And what do you think of this cold and snow?
You know, it's not so bad. I was actually nervous. Like, I was really getting nervous. I was like, I might not go. It might be too cold for me. But then I got this wonderful gear supplied to me by Want My Look, and now I feel fresh and warm, and snow's no problem.
Yes, we need to go to Want My Look. Speaking of, I want that look, because I'm digging it. It's rocking. And look at player. Now, are you going to the movies? Have you seen any yet?
I haven't. I just got in this morning.
Oh my gosh.
You're my very first everything.
How exciting.
You're my very first. I'm so excited.
Me too. I'm your first, your last, your everything. But now, so you're here tonight. There's a movie you have to go see called Director's Cut. Go see it. It's with Penn Teller. Crazy movie.
Yeah.
But so tell us, like, what's next for you after Sundance?
Well, I'm hosting LA Travel Magazine Party next week in LA, so just flying back and forth from there. But yeah, hosting, live streaming, acting, all this good stuff.
Doing your thing,
doing
right?
Doing my thing, just living my life and letting people watch it online for, like, ever.
And now, what is it for those who are watching now that you want to tell them that they might not know about you?
Well, I don't really like the cold, but I will come to Sundance just for that.
Just for that. And on that note, I'm Max Tucci for Ion South Florida.
Now, I'm particularly interested in what Dr. Weaver said about the attitude of the family to children. Because we have an absolutely extraordinary attitude in our culture and in various other cultures, high civilizations, to the new member of human society. Instead of saying frankly to children, "How do you do? Welcome to the human race. We are playing a game. And we are playing by the following rules. We want to tell you what the rules are so that you'll know your way around. And when you've understood what rules we're playing by, when you get older, you may be able to invent better ones. But instead of that, we still retain an attitude to the child that he is on probation. He's not really a human being. He's a candidate for humanity. Therefore, to preserve the role of parent or to preserve the role of teacher, you have to do what they do in the Arthur Murray School of Dancing, which is that they string you out. They don't tell you all the story about dancing, because if they tell you, you'll learn in a few weeks and go away. And you'll know it. But instead, they want to keep you on. And in just this way, we have a whole system of preparation of the child for life, which always is preparation and never actually gets there. In other words, we have a system of schooling which starts with grades. And we get this little creature into the thing with a kind of, "Come on, kitty, kitty, kitty." And we get it always preparing for something that's going to happen. So you go into nursery school as preparation for kindergarten. You go into kindergarten as preparation for first grade. And then you see you go up the grades till you get to high school. And then comes a time when maybe if we can get you fascinated enough with this system, you go to college. And then when you go to college, if you're smart, you get into graduate school and stay a perpetual student and go back to be a professor and just go round and round in the system. But in the ordinary way, they don't encourage quite that. They want you after graduate school or after graduation, commencement as it's called, beginning to get out into the world with a capital W. And so, you know, you've been trained for this and now you've arrived. But when you get out into the world at your first sales meeting, they've got the same thing going again, because they want you to make that quota. And if you do make it, they give you a higher quota. And come along about 45 years of age, maybe you're vice president. And you suddenly it dawns on you that you've arrived. With a certain sense of having been cheated, because it is just the same as things. Life feels the same as it always felt. And you are conditioned to be in desperate need of a future. So the final goal that this culture prepares for us is called retirement. When you will be a senior citizen and you will have the wealth and the leisure to do what you've always wanted, but you will at the same time have impotence, a rotten prostate, and false teeth, and no energy. So the whole thing, from beginning to end, is a hoax. And furthermore, some other aspects of the hoax, just for kicks. you are involved, by and large, in a very strange business system which divides your day into work and play. Work is something that everybody does, and you get paid to do it because nobody could care less about doing it. In other words, it is so abominable and boring that you can get paid for doing it. And the object of doing this is to make money. And the object of making money is to go home and enjoy the money that you've made. When you've got it, you see, you can buy pleasure. And that this is a complete fallacy. Money never can buy pleasure, because all pleasures depend upon not putting down a symbol of power, money, but upon disciplines. In other words, now in Sausalito, where I live, we have pier after pier full of fine boats, motor cruisers, sailing boats, all sorts of things, which nobody ever uses. Okay. Because they've been bought on the falling for the ad line that if you buy this thing, you will have pleasure, you will have status, you will have something or other. But then they suddenly discover that having a boat requires the art of seamanship, which is difficult but rewarding. Therefore, nobody has time for it, and all they do with the boats is have cocktail parties on them at the weekend. And in myriads of ways, you see, you go home, we're the wealthiest people in the world, and you would think that having earned your money and go home, you would have an orgy and a great banquet and so on, but nobody does. They eat a TV dinner, which is just a warmed-over airline food, and then they spend the evening looking at an electronic reproduction of life, which is divided from you by a glass screen. You can't touch it, you can't smell it, it has no color, except maybe if you're very wealthy it has color. But by and large, it doesn't. And you look at this thing, and you don't. You have a strange feeling, you see, that the whole procession of grades that was leading to something in the future, to that goodie, that gorgeous, voluptuous goodie that was lying at the end of the line, it never quite turns up. And this is because from the beginning, we condition our children to a defective sense of identity. And this, I think, is the most important feature in the whole thing, that a child grows into our culture, and as I repeat, this is not only Western culture, it's equally true in Japan, an area of which I can speak with some first-hand knowledge. We condition the child in a way that sets the child a life problem which is insoluble and therefore attended by constant frustration. And as a result of this problem being insoluble, it is perpetually postponed to the future, so that one is educated to live in the future, and one is not ever educated to live today. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, the philosophy of carpe diem, let us drink today for tomorrow we die, and not make any plans. What I am saying is that making plans for the future is of use only to people who are capable of living completely in the present. Because when you make plans for the future and they mature, you are, if you can't live in the present, you are not able to enjoy the future for which you have planned. Because you will have in you a kind of syndrome, whereby happiness consists in promises and not in direct and immediate realizations. So long as you feel that tomorrow it will come. You see, on a dollar bill, it always says promise to pay. It's a promissory note. And nobody ever can come across, because the promise is tomorrow. And as if we say in common speech, tomorrow never comes. But everything is based on the idea, you see, that you will get it tomorrow, and you can enjoy yourself today so long as tomorrow looks bright. But Confucius once said, a man who understands the Tao in the morning can die contentedly in the evening. That is to say, if you have ever lived one complete moment, you can be ready to die. You can say, well, that was it. That was the good, that I've had it. You see? But if you never live that complete moment, death is always a guy who like comes into a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, "Time, gentlemen, please." And you say, "Oh, please, one more drink." "Not yet." Because you haven't really have the feeling that you ever had it, that you ever got there. Now then, the main factor in this kind of conditioning seems to me to be, as I said, the way in which we give children a sense of identity. And in this respect, we do something extraordinarily odd. We define a person. Consider this for a moment, this word person. Harry Emerson Fosdick once wrote a book called How to Be a Real Person. And this, in translation, means how to be a genuine fake. Because the word person means a mask. The persona, the mask worn by actors in Greco-Roman drama, which was a megaphone-mouthed mask, so that through which persona, the sound goes. And so at the beginning of a play script, you will see the dramatis personae, the persons of the drama, that is to say, the list of the masks that the actors are going to wear. But the word has so fallen from its original use that to be a person has come to mean your real identity, your true, sincere, honest self, the person. And we say of someone then, he's a real person. That means he's genuine. But we have confused, you see, the individual organism with the person, with, that is to say, its role. And we have defined the role of the person in such a way that it condemns everybody so defined to perpetual frustration. Now, how is this so? When you are a child, you, your parents, your peers, your teachers, your uncles and aunts are very anxious to define you. And what they are going to tell you is that you are a free agent. You are responsible. That is to say, you are an independent first cause. You are an origin of actions and thoughts and feelings. And we can praise you or blame you for what you do. And above all, we require of you that you love us. You love your parents, you love your brothers and sisters. As Fred said, a child is not allowed to say, to let that baby sister go back where it came from, because that is not nice. All nice children love their brothers and sisters and their parents. Not, of course, because we tell you to do so, but because you would want to do it yourself. You see now here what's going on. You are required and commanded to do certain things which will be appreciated only if you do them voluntarily. Now, you see, when your identity is defined by society, you cannot resist it. You don't have the knowledge, you don't have the wisdom, you don't have the resources to understand that something's being put over on you. You cannot but help believe the definition of you as a free agent. But you believe yourself to be a free agent as a result of not being free. That is to say, of being hopelessly unable to resist society's identification of you. So, in the whole sense of our personality, there is a contradiction. And that is why the sense of ego, of being oneself, is simultaneously a sense of frustration. The feeling of I-ness, so far as most people are concerned, is a feeling of tension between the eyes and behind them. Trigent Barrow, a remarkable man, did some studies about two kinds of awareness, which he called ditension and cotension. Ditentive is the normal kind of awareness that we have of being a skin-encapsulated ego, of being separate from the environment, and of confronting an external objective world of which we are the independent observer. And this myth, he said, goes hand in hand with a physical state, which is a state of tension between the eyes. Then he defined co-tension as another form of awareness, which you might call a certain kind of openness, in which you realize that the external world is just as much you as anything inside your skin, and that you are not something that comes into this world on probation and doesn't really belong. This is, you see, the attitude that we foster in the child. But that you are something not that comes into the world, but comes out of it. In the same way as a flower comes out of a plant or a fruit comes out of a tree. That you are an expression. You, as a human being, are a symptom of nature. And that you really belong there, and that, furthermore, your actual self, what is finally and fundamentally you, is not a separate and lonely part of the world, but the real you is the world itself, everything that there is, expressing itself as this particular organism here and now, and of course, as you look across the room, as all these other organisms in their here and now, we are all tits on the same sow, if I may put it so crudely. Or if you want to put it more poetically, rays from the same sun. Now? Now, children very often ask their parents, you see, as a result of having been given this funny sense of identity, Mommy, who would I have been if my father had been someone else? This is a very common child's question, because the child gets the message from the parents using the English language, the French language, the German language, or whatever, that I am somewhat in my body. You gave me my body, but who am I to whom this was given? You see? You can say to a girl in our culture, darling, you're absolutely gorgeous. You're so beautiful. And she says, how like a man. All you think about is bodies. I may be beautiful, but that's my parents gave me my body. But I want to be admired for myself and not for my chassis. And this poor girl is a chauffeur. She's alienated from her body. And she doesn't take any credit, doesn't assume any responsibility for being what she is physically, and this is, of course, as much true of men as of women. It is a common cultural attitude. We say, I have a body. We don't say, I am a body. We feel a very sharp distinction, in other words, between our consciousness, which is a kind of focused attention, together with all those actions that we are able to perform voluntarily, on the one hand, and on the other hand, everything both within us and outside us that seems merely to happen to us. Consider for a moment breathing. Do you breathe or are you breathed? You can feel it either way. If you become conscious of breathing, you get the sense that you are doing it in the same way as thinking or walking. But if you forget about it, it goes on. And you don't have to do it at all. That is why breathing exercises are fundamental in all meditation practices in the Orient. Because you can understand through breathing and through the experience of breathing that there really is no differentiation between the involuntary experience and the voluntary experience. But when you set up game rules whereby you identify all that you do voluntarily with you and all that happens involuntarily with the other, with what happens to you, and then you put a gulf between these things, not realizing, and this is the secret that is never given away, that self and other are inseparable. Just in the same way that the front and the back of a coin are different but identical. There's all one coin. So in exactly the same way, the experience of self and the experience of other are mutually necessary. You wouldn't know what you meant by self unless you knew other. You wouldn't know other unless you knew what you meant by self. They are therefore polarities, like north and south pole of a magnet. They're inseparable. But that secret doesn't get out because civilized language and thought ignores the fact that all classes, all logical classes, and words are, after all, labels on classes, are so constructed that they are intellectual boxes, and every box which has an inside also must have an outside. And we think that insides exist apart from outsides, and outsides apart from insides. We don't realize that although they are opposed, they go together. And you see, that is the secret of the whole thing. That is what the child is not let onto. And so instead, the child is defined as a stranger in the earth, and not as a symptom of the earth. And as a result of that, we have the vast, terrifying social problem of alienation, of feeling that the world outside human skins is unfeeling, fully automatic stupidity, which we have to fight and dominate. Otherwise, it will swallow us up and condemn us to the imaginary terrors of everlasting nothingness. Now, I feel in a way that when we say, I wasn't responsible for being born, you know, one of the great problems of psychotherapy today is passing the buck. By a kind of superficial Freudian attitude, you, as a juvenile delinquent, are not responsible for what you do because it was your parents who fouled you up. And so they write articles in the press that instead of prosecuting the children, we ought to prosecute the parents. So they haul the parents in, but the parents say, I know we're mixed up, but that was the fault of our parents. And it all goes back to a guy called Adam, and he blamed it on Eve, and she blamed it on the serpent. And God said about the serpent, I'm not responsible for the serpent. He did it on his own, you see, because the serpent is the left hand of God. And what we call God, Jehovah, Jesus Christ, etc., that's the right hand. For Jesus Christ sits on the right hand of the Father. Nobody ever says who sits on the left. Because let not your left hand know what your right hand doeth. See? My temper got the better of me. I didn't really mean it. My lusts got the better of me. I'm really not responsible for them. They were given to me. You see? Now, all this idea that we're laboring under a definition of the self, which is extremely limited, so that we, for example, acknowledge thinking and walking and we're doing things with our hands and speaking, but we don't acknowledge that we are growing our hair and beating our hearts. That is defined as happening to us. Birth is defined as something that happened to us. And we feel that was my father's responsibility. He had a dirty gleam in his eye and went after my mother and so on, and he did it.
Excuse me, we'll have to interrupt you. I'm taking that up.
Yes, all right.
Because there is this point about responsibility. And one way of looking at it is that we are really not responsible for what happened to our past. We are responsible for what happened to us beginning right now.
Yes.
But we're not responsible for what happened to us before.
No, but you see, I feel this is a hoax.
So I'd like to hear you talk about.
You see, look, let's suppose now that we'll follow the theory of those astronomers who maintain that the universe is not a steady state thing, but there was an enormous bang billions of years ago, and from this bang, all the galaxies were thrown out into space. Now, then you look back at this as something which happened in the past and which is, as it were, the cause of the present. But what I would say is that bang is still going on. When you take a lovely bottle of black ink and throw it as hard as you can at a white wall and smash it, all it goes floosh like this, you know. And
In the center, it's dense, but on the out fringes, it has all kinds of interesting curlicues. And that's all you see, one splash. Now, in the same way, we are at the moment sitting in this room and talking and thinking, we are all the little curlicues out on the end of the original cosmic bang. We are it. We are not effects of it. Because to think that you are separate from the Big Bang is simply a matter of definition. It's a way of talking. We separate events from each other in order to measure them. That is to say, the notion that there are distinct things and distinct events in the physical world is a calculus. It is like pretending that a curve is a series of points. And so, in the same way, supposing you have a wiggle. Now, you've got a wiggly line, you see, and the whole world is wiggly lines. Clouds, mountains, people, rivers, everything is wiggly lines. Now, how much of a wiggly line is a wiggle? You see, what is one wiggle? And you can see that this is a very arbitrary matter. So we see the more obvious wiggles in the world, and we define them as people. Each of you is a wiggle. And this wiggle is you.
I'd like to talk and ask you about one wiggle. What about the wiggle of the child fighting to get out of the uterus through the birth canal and be born?
Yeah.
How do you view that in the general...
Well, that's simply a repetition of the original explosion.
Is he a participant right then and there?
Of course.
Or...
Of course.
Do you view this... This is a natural expression of the entire Earth?
Yes, exactly. This is a repetition of the original explosion. Go, man, you see? And,
So then responsibility would start with...
It starts with...
Really.
It starts before birth. Because the definition of yourself as beginning only... When shall we put it? Where did you begin? When at parturition? At conception? Or when you were an evil gleam in your father's eye? When did you begin? Let's go back. You began on the first dawn of creation, whenever that was. That because you did it. See, everybody's pretending they didn't. And you can kind of play a game. This is what gurus do, you see, Zen masters and so on. They give you a funny look. And you say, well, I have a problem. Please, teacher, I'm this little me, and I'm caught in this thing called life. I got mixed up with all these tubes and nerves, and it's uncomfortable, and I don't know what to do about it because it's all going to fall apart. And so the teacher says, like whether it's Sri Ramana Maharshi or whether it's a Zen teacher, who is mixed up in this thing? Who are you? Who asked this question? Show me. Find yourself. You say, well, that's just me. And he says, oh, come on. You? Don't make me laugh. See, so eventually the person feels very bugged because the teacher is calling his bluff. And you are not the Lord God in the Jehovah sense of Christianity, who is the cosmic technocrat, who knows all the answers to everything. But you are the Lord God in the Hindu sense, who is different, because the Hindu God doesn't know how he does everything in the sense that he doesn't translate it into words. He can't explain it, because there's no point in explaining it. You open and close your hand without knowing how you do it, and yet you surely do it. But you can't put it into words how it happens, unless you're a physiologist. And then even so, it doesn't help you much to open and close your hand better than anybody else. See? So you do know how to do it, but you can't explain it. Because the thing, words are a very clumsy way of talking about something which, from the standpoint of words and the standpoint of logic, is a very, very complicated process. So if you ask Shiva how he dances the cosmos, he would say, I just do it. Like you say, well, I just open and close my hand. So the guru says to you, listen, Shiva, don't kid me, you know, that you're not Shiva. But you're just this thing called Mary Smith or John Doe, etc. Ha ha. And everybody says, uh-oh, you can't admit that, because, you see, if I did admit that, I would have to be considered responsible, and I would be considered crazy, and I would feel that I really was one with this whole scheme of things. And that's, you see, the secret that we don't let the children know. In all, well, not in all, but in many cultures, initiation into manhood consists precisely in finding that out. They finally get around to saying to you, after all, you know, we've been pretending all this time that you were just this little boy or little girl, but now we're going to let you in on the real story. But not in this culture. That's the problem. In this culture, we do have an initiation into adult life called psychoanalysis. And everybody is ruined by education. And then this can't be helped because they have to know all the conventions. And just like you, to preserve beef, you make it salt. And when you're going to cook it, you have to soak the salt out of it. So in the same way, to make a child tolerable companion, you have to... you have to be salted with education. Then when that mixes up all your natural instincts, you have to be psychoanalyzed in order to be straightened out and cured of your education, cured of your upbringing. But the difficulty is, you see, that the assumptions of psychoanalysis and of a good deal of psychotherapy in various types and schools do not include the insight that you are basically the works. They have, in other words, that simply because, historically speaking, psychotherapy originated in the 19th century and therefore still carries on the 19th century assumptions about the nature of the universe. And all those 19th century assumptions about the universe were a put-down. They included the myth, you see, that the universe is actually blind energy. It is essentially stupid. And man's intelligence and man's values and man's consciousness are a fluke in the world. And so this myth is that the world, the man, in other words, is not a symptom of the world, like an apple tree is a symptom. An apple is a symptom of an apple tree. But man is a fluke, a kind of a joke, a chance. And that to be realistic and hard-headed and factual, in other words, a strong man, you must realize that you are caught in this trap and face the facts. So then, this, for the West at any rate, this 19th century philosophy of man's place in the world and his identity has become the most plausible common sense. In other words, people say they are Christians, they say they are Jews, they say they are theosophists, Vedantists, Buddhists, etc., etc., but they are not. Because they know in their heart of hearts, whatever they choose to believe, that the world is as described in the 19th century myth, because that's become our common sense. If people were Christians, they'd be screaming in the streets. They're not screaming in the streets. They'd be taking full-page ads. They'd be sponsoring TV programs about the tremendous urgency of this Christian bit, and they're not doing anything of the kind. A few Jehovah's Witnesses are doing it, but they are, even they are fairly polite when they come to your front door. They show no urgency, really. So they don't believe it, because the plausible myth of our age is the myth of the fully automatic model of the universe, in which man is a fluke, and which he doesn't really belong. He's a chance operation, and when you're dead, you're dead, and that's all there is to it. And that's so plausible that really almost everyone believes in it, without realizing that it is made out of whole cloth. It's nothing but a myth. It's a way of looking at things, a way of striking an attitude. But this is the powerful, powerful idea that governs our children and that gives us our sense of basic identity, alienation, so that we live always in expectation of a future, which, of course, never happens. Well, it's enough for me for the moment.